morning, Dan.
Good morning, Scott.
This is a return to our book review series, but maybe instead of calling it the bookcase this time, we should call it the magazine rack.
I think so. The periodical section, as they used to say in the public library, I think.
And that's because we came across a couple of articles in an easily accessible magazine called Harper's. And the last two issues have had some really remarkable pieces. As part of my continuing interest in how we addressed the outbreak of COVID-19, there was a piece by Jason Blakely called Doctor's Orders. And it really does capture for me, and I know we'll go into more detail, many of the conundrums, puzzles, ethical concerns, and vision of science that arose for me, especially at the outset of the pandemic.
And as I actually, it's kind of a coincidence. I was looking for that article towards the end of July. And so the store that I went to only had the July edition of Harper's. And there's a fascinating article in here called Doing the Work, the Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Wokeness. And so we decided to compare, contrast, and discuss these two articles side by side.
And we do believe, and we will eventually get to how these are related to our own field of mental health, psychiatry, addictions, psychology, etc. If we start though with the Jason Blakely article, and both of these right now you can actually access for free by simply going to harpers.org. You get two free articles without having to subscribe. Although Dan, I understand.
You know, I've been so fascinated by these articles that I sent in my little cardboard piece of paper yesterday. I'm subscribing. It's only like $25 for the year, and actually it might even be like $30 for 2 years. But I thought these articles were fantastic, and there's several other really good articles in both editions as well. So,
you know, many of the print magazines that I've received over the year and subscribed to loyally, I've let them lapse. One of them was my subscription to The Atlantic magazine. I just didn't find it interesting, and I thought the stories began to reflect a sort of single point of view, and I ended up not being very stimulated. The other is a magazine that I have subscribed to for many, many years called Skeptical Inquirer, which is the publication for the Skeptic Society. And it really was at one point an overview of science. But for me, the controversies of science were rarely covered in the magazine. And the ones that were, I didn't think were all that controversial. For example, I just don't think it matters that a small percentage of people believe in Bigfoot, or that 70% of Americans by last polling think there might be such a thing as angels. I just don't think that's a big scientific controversy. But what I do think is a controversy is what Jason Blakely points out about how COVID was handled during its outbreak, and specifically how it was handled by politicians. And in my review, and I'll be interested to hear your take, the concern I had was that policy decisions were made, and the primary reason given was the science says. And Blakely's point is that that's not science. It doesn't speak in a single unifying voice, but rather an attempt on the part of leaders to avoid responsibility for policy decisions. And the result has been devastating. The public has been further divided, and the reputation of science, he argues, has been blemished because science cannot solve many of the serious moral difficulties and differences of opinion that exist at the policy level.
Because the action of a virus in a complex human society, the science of that is descriptive rather than proscriptive or exact. Did you define scientism?
Hang on, let me scroll up to that in his article.
I think I have it here.
Okay, go ahead.
The overextension of scientific authority or scientism has become so ubiquitous that it now hides in plain sight, influencing every sphere of American life, from policing and economics to dating and psychology.
And I want to be clear, Dan, in case people are listening and thinking, wait a minute, is this another rehash about whether masks work or not, or whether vaccines were helpful or not? That is not what this article is about. Rather, it's about assumptions that were made about the outcomes we were aiming at and squelching any debate about that by claiming the authority of science. So, for example, Blakely talks about how it was assumed that the preservation of life, all life, was the assumed motive behind much of the policies, when quality of life, educational objectives of children, et cetera, were seen as secondary or actually unimportant. And the key here is we didn't even talk about it. We didn't get to decide. I'm thinking of that famous quote or moment during the pandemic when Cuomo, the then governor of New York, said that if you didn't agree with him, essentially you want to kill my grandma.
So there's a little outtake from the article, and it says politicians cloaked ethical and ideological aims in theories that claimed the authority of fact. Yeah. They were using science, they were using what they considered science, which is really more like scientism, to further their political agenda. And people formed camps, and there was no skepticism or dialogue in between. And I kind of feel like it's still that way. I think people still feel the same way they felt during the pandemic now. People who believed that you should wear a mask and isolate and get your vaccine probably haven't really changed their minds much. And people that believe that we should have focused on business interests and keep life moving forward probably still feel the same way.
And I think Blakely's point, and this was the point I was making, and at least what I tried to maintain on my public profile on Facebook, was that divide became even greater because of the way politicians used science to undermine any kind of dissent, or more importantly, democratic debate and conversation. And Blakely's point is that this is not that it didn't exist beforehand, but that it certainly accelerated and was applauded by politicians, friends, and such in the media. Science can be an advisor, is his point, but not the decision maker. And you say that people haven't changed in terms, perhaps, of their position with regard to the pandemic, but you also see this same kind of debate in discussions about the budget of the federal government and whether or not we're incurring too much debt, climate discussions, and other cultural issues, including gender identity, that the science says is meant to stifle debate rather than address very serious moral and ethical dilemmas. And I think this is sort of related to the Baruma article, which was the second piece, the one that you found when you were trying to get a copy of the one that I sent you the link to.
Yes, the Baruma article, it takes a critical look at the concept of wokeism and likens it to a religious movement that has its roots in early Protestantism. Hmm. And some of the specific aspects of that are the public confession. So somebody who commits a faux pas publicly apologizes, goes ahead and does some work to become more woke and in essence absolved. And I suppose the flip side of that is that people who don't do that are canceled.
And so his point, and I think somehow connected to Blakely's idea, is that it results in performative acts, or what some might call a performative act, as you say, canceling, voicing what are considered the correct or right opinions on controversial subjects of the day. And the cost of that is actual serious and difficult moral and policy decisions. What in the heck do we do about this? It's much easier to say, yes, everybody has a right to live where they want and have housing. And if they want freedom to do what they want in their life, we have no right to say no to that. The more difficult decision is people living on the streets, dying on the streets, and the lack, in fact, of affordable housing across the country as the economy divides into increasingly rich and isolated people and people who don't have the means.
He cites in this article a specific example of a fancy private high school or secondary school in New York City where the tuition is, I don't know, $50,000 or something, maybe more. And this school has three diversity and inclusion officers that have full-time jobs, full-time salary, rather than potentially paying more tax dollars to improve the education and opportunities for inner city children. They spend money on their diversity programs.
So
not
it's
that diversity isn't a bad thing
to
think about or work with, but there are better ways to improve the inclusivity of our society than hire those officers.
And I love that you feel like you have to make that special announcement, because I think that is part of the fear that people can have tending to these kinds of difficult conversations, that you have to situate yourself constantly in order not to be attacked for holding the wrong opinion. But these ideas aren't new either. So Antonicello, not from Mickey Mouse Club, but an author, wrote a book probably 20 years ago called The Tyranny of Kindness. And in there, she talked about single parent heads of households living way under the poverty line, poor families from lower economic classes, having to go see a social worker being paid $90,000 a year to dole out benefits and then monitoring them for drug use and childcare, et cetera. And her argument was that in our attempt to be good, we don't do good. In fact, the primary people who benefit are the members of the server class, the people who take care of them. They survive, et cetera, but the resources never quite make it to the bottom. Now, whether her argument is right or not, what I like about Baruma's piece is it makes you wonder, is having three diversity officers really a good utilization of resources when what we need to do is make difficult decisions about what are you actually going to do to raise opportunities for folks who don't have as many as those in the privileged class.
So how do we relate these articles to mental health?
So I'm thinking that there's this strong cultural element involved in our work, and we hide sometimes under the guise of science. The classic example, I think, is just to look back at our history. Not surprising that Freud was interested in sex. He lived in a Victorian era. Not surprising that Skinner was and Watson were interested in behaviorism. That was the industrial era. During the Cold War, we had strategic and systemic therapies.
Huh.
And one last one, of course, cognitive therapy comes of age during a time when we have the most literate college-educated population in history, thinking that the way to solve your problems is by thinking them through. Not hard to make the connection that culture influences psychotherapy, and psychotherapists can influence the culture.
Right, and I live that every day because the places that I work are always asking me to talk about the neurobiology and the neuroscience. How does my brain work, doctor? What is addiction? What's going on in my brain? And I find myself being pretty fascinated by it as a complete scientific explanation of what's going on. And then I realize I think of it in terms of cases, and my neurobiology lectures may be very interesting to people, but they don't cure them. And they're still embedded in the culture. And it's way more complicated than the way neurons talk to each other.
And I can imagine some listening thinking, well, are you just waking up to the fact that our field has roots in culture? And I would say, clearly not. What I think the purpose of the conversation would be is to talk and have this challenging conversation about what does this mean? For example, right now, in addition to neurobiology, our field is on the experience of trauma. And it's simply assumed to be the case. The cultural referent, the cultural pressures and causes, what's happening outside the therapy room that might lead this to be the focus of our work are not under discussion. They're just accepted as is. And of course, the researchers come in and says, the science says these approaches are the ones to use.
And your program has to be trauma-informed. You can't get funding unless you're trauma-informed, you're out of favor.
And when you look for evidence that adopting any one of these innovations, going back 100 years to the start of our field, led to better outcomes, you simply cannot find it.
I would say most fields study, most industries have clearly improved. They have quality improvement processes. They know more and they know better how to do things than they did 40, 50 years ago. Not so much with the field of psychotherapy.
And again, I guess the question is, what do we do about this? There is other scientific evidence with regard to the field of mental health that shows that therapists' values, their worldview, rubs off on their clients the longer that they see us. And of course, what that means is we probably need a diverse group of providers. Because as my colleague Bruce Wampold will say, you don't want to depend on a therapist to tell you what normal is. Because what allows people to live a reasonable and functional life is simply too diverse, he would say.
So I feel like quoting from Blakely article, here we go. Humans are meaning-making creatures, and our practices, institutions, and entire social lives are expressive of our beliefs. As the philosopher Charles Taylor has put it, we are language animals, dwelling in worlds of signification. Our linguistic capacity allows for cultural change to occur far more rapidly than the pace of natural history. Even as the biological basis of our species remains stable, human life is characterized by epochal shifts in meaning that can render Homo sapiens utterly alien to one another. I think it's an expression of how polarization can happen.
Yeah. And especially when scientism creeps in, I love another quote from Blakely. He says, he cites Daniel Moynihan, the famous senator who made this statement, you're entitled to your own opinion, sir, but not your own facts. But then he goes on today and he says, today's scientistic administrators seem less and less inclined to allow people even their own opinions. Instead, they treat the facts as they define them as largely determine what counts as acceptable opinion.
And then I believe it's in the Baruba article. Opinions and statements and whatever's going on in your head is one thing, but actions are another. So it kind of gets back to the fancy private school. These statements, or he also mentions some of these large companies that put out woke statements about Black Lives Matter, nothing wrong with Black Lives Matter, but also then donate to far-right politicians. And so it's your statements that mean something. Nobody necessarily pays attention to your actions. And I think Buruma's conclusion is, what's the antidote to this problem? Well, it's having local voices heard. It's thinking about what actions are going to actually solve problems rather than just the words.
And I'm hoping that FIT can help in the development of that local knowledge and awareness when I need to be a more careful listener, when my values, when my beliefs might be unfairly influencing what I do in the room with the client. And then putting that in between us as a conversation. The frightening part to me about both articles, it would be that this wonderful specialized place where one person meets with another becomes ruled by some a priori decision about what's acceptable to talk about versus what needs to be talked about and difficult choices made.
I mean, it's the essence of the first question on the ORS, right? I felt heard, understood, and respected.
Exactly.
If there's rules to what will be respected, then that's not likely to make anybody feel very good.
Yeah. Or keep them engaged.
Yes. I highly recommend these articles. I think we've kind of ventured into new territory. We talked about this earlier, that when you read a book, there's so much material that you can draw from in a discussion, and usually some common threads between two, probably even random books. But when you pick an article, which, like you mentioned, a book, you can funnel down into a few concepts. An article, it's kind of a reverse funnel.
Yeah.
I highly recommend these two articles. Therapists are part of the culture.
Yeah.
You know, we have to be aware of these things.
Yeah.
We can't just say, oh, you know, I don't go in that. I don't talk about that stuff with my client.
Exactly.
You know, it's really important.
And we can't decide a priori either what's going to be respected and what's not if we hope to keep people engaged in conversation. And the sad part to me about much of what happened in COVID was it increased polarization. And Blakely makes this point that we can view conspiracy theories as utter nuttiness and irrational behavior, or we can view them as political statements of resistance to an unwillingness by those in power to talk about what the concerns of the people are.
Yeah, I think that's a really, really important idea.
Thanks so much, Dan.
Thank you.